My name is Dave Emery, if you're not familiar with my voice. And what we're doing today for 12 long hours, beginning immediately, is the Uncle Sam and the Swastika special. This has become something of a KFJC Memorial Day tradition. Memorial Day is the holiday on which we pause to remember our dead from fallen wars. Our most costly foreign war in terms of both money and casualties was World War II. And in as much as this is Memorial Day weekend, what we're going to do is to memorialize the dead from foreign wars by coming to understand, hopefully, the causes of foreign wars, at least better than we do to date. In that regard, we're going to be playing information for 12 hours about the corporate connections to fascism. And without any further yakety-yak on my part, we're going to get right down to brass tacks. We're going to begin with a miscellaneous archive show, specifically miscellaneous archive show M11. It's entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika. And the first hour was recorded on May 23rd, 1980, when myself and my then co-host Mark Ortiz guest-hosted the late Mama O'Shea's program on KPFA, the Pacifica station in Berkeley. This first side of the program, and by the way, the first program was about an hour in length, the excerpts, that is, and there are supplements recorded over the years. This first side is about 45 minutes in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go.
The title of our broadcast is Uncle Sam and the Swastika, U.S. industrial cooperation with Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. On October 19th, 1936, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, William Dodd, wore. Ambassador Dodd wrote to Roosevelt, "Much as I believe in peace as our best policy, I cannot avoid the fears which Wilson emphasized more than once in conversations with me, August 15, 1915, and later. The breakdown of democracy in all Europe will be a disaster to the people. But what can you do? At the present moment, more than 100 American corporations have subsidiaries here or cooperative understandings. The DuPonts have three allies in Germany that are aiding in the armament business. Their chief ally is the IG Farben Company, a part of the government which gives 200,000 marks a year to one propaganda organization operating an American opinion. Standard Oil Company, New York Sub Company, sent $2 million here in December 1933 and has made $500,000 a year helping Germans make ersatz gas for war purposes. But Standard Oil cannot take any of its earnings out of the country except in goods. They do little of this, report their earnings at home, but do not explain the facts. The International Harvester Company president told me their business here rose 33% a year. Arms manufacturer, I believe, but they could take nothing out. Even our airplanes people have secret arrangements with the Krupps. General Motors Company and Ford do enormous business here through their subsidiaries and take no profits out. I mention these facts because they complicate things and add to war dangers. Well, Ambassador Dodd was taking note of a phenomenon here which very few observers have been able to take note of or willing to take note of since. What Dodd was basically taking note of was the fact that German National Socialism, or Nazism, was produced by the maneuvering of multinational corporations, and American business interests played a central role, a critical role, in this maneuvering.
Long before that memo was written, the groundwork was laid for American and international participation in the Third Reich. A lot of people aren't aware of it, but one of the earliest financial contributors to fascism and one of fascism's ideological pillars was none other than the famous American industrialist Henry Ford, Sr. That Henry Ford, the famous automobile manufacturer, gave money to the National Socialists, directly or indirectly, has never been disputed, said Konrad Heiden, one of Hitler's first biographers. Throughout the 1920s, there were numerous leaks of information about Ford's financing of Hitler, but since then they have been suppressed and forgotten. I'm reading to you from a book called Who Financed Hitler, written by James Poole and Suzanne Poole, published in 1978 by Dial Press. The Pooles have an entire chapter in their book about Ford and Hitler, and they attempt to lay down three conduits of money, through which they contend money in all probability did flow from Ford to Hitler. And I'll briefly tell you about those. Basically, the three conduits were these. First, through the White Russian Tsarist community in the United States and Europe, particularly through one Boris Brassol, who was an assistant to Grand Duke Cyril Vladimirovich, a member of the Romanov family, and one of the probable heirs to the Russian throne if the monarchy had continued in Russia. Brassol, at the same time that he was working for the Tsarists, was also a writer for Henry Ford's private newspaper, the Dearborn Independent. He made numerous trips to Europe, during which he had plenty of opportunity to convey money. The second conduit that the Pools talk about was Ford's agent for the Ford Motor Company in Germany. His name was Fuzzy Anderson, Warren Anderson, an ex-bicycle racer who was summarily recalled for no apparent reason from Germany in 1922, but who had contacts with the Nazi Party while he was in Germany. The third conduit that the Pools mentioned was through the son and the daughter-in-law of the famed opera composer and famed anti-Semite Richard Wagner. Wagner's son and daughter-in-law came to the United States with Nazi Party member Kurt Lüdecke, supposedly asking for funds for a German music festival. However, they also had dinner with Henry Ford, and according to Mrs. Wagner, Ford agreed to give them some money. But more important even than Ford's role as a financier of fascism immediately following the First World War is his role as an ideological leader of the fascist movement. Henry Ford is known to have written a book entitled The International Jew. The International Jew originally appeared as a series of newspaper articles in Ford's newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, which I recently mentioned in connection with Boris Brassol. Speaking of the International Jew and Ford's general status among fascists, the Pools write, "Not only did Hitler specifically praise Henry Ford in Mein Kampf, Hitler's well-known book, but many of Hitler's ideas were also a direct reflection of Ford's racist philosophy. There is a great similarity between the International Jew and Hitler's Mein Kampf, and some passages are so identical that it has been said Hitler copied directly from Ford's publication. Hitler also read Ford's autobiography, My Life and Work, which was published in 1922 and was a bestseller in Germany, as well as Ford's book entitled Today and Tomorrow. There can be no doubt as to the influence of Henry Ford's ideas on Hitler. Not only do Hitler's writings and practices reflect the International Jew, but one of his closest associates, Dietrich Eckart, specifically mentioned both the Protocols and the International Jew as inspiration sources for the Nazi leader." Dave, you might tell us just briefly what this Protocols business referred to here is.
Sure, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was a very famous forgery that was put together in 1905 by the Okhrana, that is the Tsarist secret police in Russia. It, I believe, is a corruption of a satiric essay by one of the French Enlightenment writers. Anyway, what it purports to be is a blueprint for an international Zionist conspiracy to dominate the world. And it has been used by anti-Semitic and right-wing regimes all around the world and over the years to basically justify their excesses against the Jewish segment of the population and others at times as well, in order to basically keep their subjects' minds off of their real problems.
In any case, the International Jew borrowed heavily from this set of ideas and elaborated on them further. The Pools continue, "If the International Jew was the Bible, then to the Nazis Henry Ford must have seemed a god. His anti-Semitic publications led many Germans to become Nazis. Baldur von Schirach, leader of the Hitler Youth Movement, stated at the post-war Nuremberg war crimes trials that he had become an anti-Semite at the age of 17 after reading The Eternal Jew, which was the International Jew's title in its German edition. "You have no idea what a great influence this book had on the thinking of German youth," von Schirach said. "The younger generation looked with envy to the symbols of success and prosperity like Henry Ford. And if he said the Jews were to blame, why, naturally, we believed him." One of Hitler's lieutenants, Christian Weber, boasted that Ford would be received like a king if he ever came to Munich. In 1923, when Hitler learned that Ford might run for president of the United States, he said, according to the Chicago Tribune, quote, "I wish that I could send some of my shock troops to Chicago and other big American cities to help in the elections. We look to Heinrich Ford as the leader of the growing fascist movement in America. We have just had his anti-Jewish articles translated and published, and the book is being circulated to millions throughout Germany."
I'd like to interrupt very briefly, Mark. It's important to note that it was Henry Ford's stature, his fame as an industrial leader, that not only gave a great deal of distribution to Nazi ideology, they were able to achieve worldwide distribution through this, but it also lent the Nazis, at that time regarded as a lunatic fringe group, much of their early respectability. And this is an important point.
Henry Ford's reward from Hitler finally came in July 1938, when on Ford's 75th birthday, he was awarded the Grand Cross of the Supreme Order of the German Eagle. Ford was the first American and the fourth person in the world to receive this medal, which was the highest decoration that could be given to any non-German citizen. Benito Mussolini, another of Hitler's early backers, had been decorated with the same honor earlier that year.
I think it's important to remember that Henry Ford received a medal which had previously been given to only three other foreigners, three other non-Germans, one of whom was Benito Mussolini. I think this is indicative and representative of Henry Ford's stature in the international fascist hierarchy. And before moving on, I'd like to note an interesting coincidence, and that is that Henry Ford's son, Edsel Ford, a member of the board of directors of the Ford Motor Corporation, was appointed to the board of directors of American IG, IG Farben's wholly owned American subsidiary. And this is interesting because IG Farben was the company that produced the gas used by Hitler in his final solution to the Jewish problem. And interestingly enough, Karl Bosch, a director of IG Farben, was president of German Ford, or chairman of the board, rather, of German Ford. And IG Farben Chemical Combine owned 40% of German Ford's stock. Well, while Henry Ford was contributing to the Nazis and helping them to formulate their ideological approaches, events were taking place in Europe which were to help pave the social and economic conditions leading to the rise of Hitler. American industrialists and financiers played a key role in setting up these conditions. In 1923, an impasse was reached between Germany and France over the cessation of coal deliveries from Germany to France under the terms of the Versailles Treaty. The French steelmaking industry of Lorraine was dependent on shipment of German coal from the Ruhr in order to keep functioning. The Germans were not meeting their quota, so the French sent troops in to occupy the coal-producing region of the Ruhr. The coal miners struck, and there was a deadlock. Basically, the French weren't getting their coal, the Germans weren't producing any, and showed no signs of changing their approach, changing their stance. Into this gap stepped a group of diplomats who were also key international financiers. Many of the most important of them were American. Their solution to the problem of German reparations was to arrange for a series of foreign loans in order to enable Germany to continue the reparations payments. These loans were set up under two different programs. One was called the Dawes Plan, D-A-W-E-S, of 1924. The other was called the Young Plan, and that was instituted in 1929. Now, between 1924, and 1931, under the Dawes and Young Plan, Germany paid out a total of 36 billion marks in reparations. In the meantime, during that same period of time, they borrowed 33 billion marks, of course, at a great profit to the institutions lending them, so that the net payment by Germany was only 3 billion marks over the 7-year period. Now, what this had the effect of doing was to concentrate economic power, because in the harsh conditions which the Dawes and Young plan imposed, the businesses which best survived were those that had access to the American loans. It was a very effective device for eliminating competition. And in fact, some of the firms used their loans in order to buy out their competition in Germany by paying higher than market prices. The chief result of the concentration of economic power which stemmed from the conditions set up by the aforementioned Dawes and Young plan was the formation of three giant cartels, one of them the IG Farben industry, which we were talking about a while ago. That was a chemical concern. The second was Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel. And the third was German General Electric, 30% owned, by the way, by American GE. These three companies comprised the backbone of German defense production. They essentially were Hitler's tools for forging the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe. And it's also important to note that these same industrial concerns played a key role in financing Hitler's takeover in 1933. All three cartels were generous contributors to the so-called National Trusteeship Fund, administered by Rudolf Hess. That money was drawn upon by the Nazis in order, as I said, to effect their 1933 takeover. IG Farben, for example, as a company and with individual directors, had basically contributed 45% of the National Trusteeship Fund. I'd like to, try and illustrate, really, the mechanism by which all of the transactions that we've discussed so far and the ones we're going to be discussing in this broadcast were brought about. Rather than attempt to sort of delineate for you all of the complicated corporate maneuvering, which I don't think I could probably do past the point, I'm gonna drop some names and sort of give you an idea of the kind of intersections which resulted in the cooperation between U.S. business and Nazi Germany. I'd like to focus on, the fascinating set of connections of a man named Kurt Schroeder, S-C-H-R-O-D-E-R. Schroeder was one of Hitler's most prominent backers and one of his earliest backers. And one of his most important functions was his directorship, of all of the ITT companies in Germany. ITT played a leading role in Germany. They were one of the dominant interests in the German electrical industry, along with German General Electric. They were also very, very heavily involved in German armaments production, most notably the Lorenz Company, L-O-R-E-N-Z. Shortly before the outbreak of war, purchased a 28% controlling interest in Focke Wulf aircraft, which throughout the course of the war produced one of the top-line German warplanes. And ITT also produced a great many parts for wireless, for navigational instruments, and so forth. As I said, Kurt Schroeder was basically made the trustee of all ITT interests in Germany, and he, along with a man named Emil Meyer, sat on the board of directors of all of the ITT subsidiaries in Germany. Now, Kurt Schroeder was a member of a very famous transatlantic, very powerful transatlantic banking family. The Schroeder family had a bank in London called the J. Henry Schroeder Company. The J. Henry Schroeder Company of London acted as the exclusive agent for all German business, which was being conducted in England before the war. Another Schroeder bank was the J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation of New York. The J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation profited heavily from the reparations loans, which we described earlier, and the legal negotiations for the Schroeder reparation loans were handled in Germany by the law firm of Albert and Westrick. Both Heinz Albert and Gerhard Westrick were German spies in the United States in both World Wars. The American end of the Schroeder reparations loans was handled by the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell, the senior partners in Sullivan and Cromwell at that time were two names which figure very, very prominently in American diplomacy, American politics over the course of the last half a century. The senior partners in Sullivan and Cromwell were John Foster and Alan Dulles.
John Foster Dulles being Secretary of State under Eisenhower. Alan Dulles was the co-founder of the CIA and was also active in the OSS, which was American intelligence before the CIA was created.
And Alan Dulles was a member of the board of directors of the Schroeder Bank until 1944. Interestingly enough, American IG, IG Farben's wholly owned subsidiary, did all of their banking with the Schroeder Bank. Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles' law firm, handled all of the legal work for American IG. And interestingly enough, in 1936, the investment banking business of the J. Henry Schroeder Corporation merged with another very famous banking family. The J. Henry Schroeder Corporation became Schroeder Rockefeller & Company. And the vice president of Schroeder Rockefeller & Company was Avery Rockefeller, who was the son of Percy Rockefeller, brother of John D., the founder of the family fortune and father of Nelson and David Rockefeller. Perhaps the single most interesting connection of the Schroeder banking empire concerned an account in one of their banks in Cologne, Germany. This account was known as the Sonderkonto S, S-O-N-D-E-R-K-O-N-T-O, or Special Account S. The Special Account S was drawn upon by Heinrich Himmler for the day-to-day operations of the SS, the ferocious Nazi elite guards. Kurt Schroeder, his official title in Germany, was Senior SS Group Leader. What that meant was that he was the leader of a group of industrialists who deposited money in the Sonderkonto S, the Special Account S account, in the Steinbank in Cologne. As I said, Himmler drew upon that for the day-to-day financing of the SS, and in return, the industrialists not only received protection from the SS, but the main contributors, the really big ones, got first pick of the SS's slave labor pool and were able to avail themselves of that in their business concerns. And it's interesting to note, too, that the Sonderkonto S was contributed to by AT&T, American-based multinational corporation. It was also contributed to by the German-American Petroleum Company, 94% owned Standard Oil subsidiary, and German General Electric was an early contributor as well.
Well, what we want to emphasize in closing this little part of the discussion is that this was not an aberration, that this, we're just showing you one little piece of the entire picture. In reality, there was a whole incredibly well linked together, incredibly complexly woven network of multinational corporations and their managers, executives, and major stockholders that actually predates the First World War and is international in scope and has been around for a long time. Now, we realize that this whole subject is really complicated and has a lot of details to it, and we also imagine that a lot of this is shocking. A lot of this isn't common knowledge.
The sort of transatlantic financial axis, its existence permitted the Germans to work out a marvelous, really an evil, but very marvelous system of economic warfare against all of their allies. By manipulating international cartel agreements, they were able to not only obtain valuable technology and raw materials for themselves, but they were able to actually restrict war production in their enemies and potential enemies. A superb but long out of print book entitled All Honorable Men discusses this. The book All Honorable Men was written by a man named James Stuart Martin. And James Stuart Martin was chief of the economic warfare section of the U.S. Department of Justice during the Second World War, and as such, one of his duties was to investigate potential production bottlenecks in German industry, which would offer the Air Force a good opportunity to disrupt German wartime manufacturing. And of his search for bottlenecks and what he discovered through that, James Stuart Martin writes, "As we worked on the search for bottlenecks in German production, we began to find a close relation between international business agreements for the restriction of production and the kinds of products which were especially critical in wartime. The trouble was that these international arrangements which pointed up the importance of certain commodities in the German economy had also resulted in restriction of production in the United States. Assistant Attorney General Arnold's men found that one company, Rome and Haas of Philadelphia, was not able itself to produce enough transparent plastic sheets for bomber noses. But because Rome and Haas of Philadelphia had DuPont under a special agreement as part of a more complex and wider four-way arrangement involving DuPont and two German firms, IG Farben Industry and Rome and Haas of Darmstadt, DuPont was permitted to turn out only a limited quantity of the plastic sheets. While government expediters were tearing their hair over slow deliveries, DuPont was writing to Roman Haas of Philadelphia that they would have to tell the government about the agreement unless Roman Haas would lift the restriction. We discovered even more spectacular complications, such as those in the three-way arrangements among the aircraft equipment firms Bendix of the United States, Siemens of Germany, and Zenith in England. Under one of those arrangements, the American firm in 1941 had stood by an agreement with the Siemens firm of Germany and forbade British Zenith to grant patent licenses so that the British Air Ministry could expand production of aircraft carburetors. Almost a year after Dunkirk, Zenith wrote to Bendix that, quote, "The ministry suggested they would prefer to manufacture the carburetors themselves and asked us to waive all our rights in the matter. We have told them plainly that we are not prepared under any circumstances to agree to this or to alter one item of our contract with you. You know that we have got to win the war if we are going to survive, and it is because we know we shall win and survive that we are anxious that post-war business should not be complicated by departing from the conditions of the contract in the meantime and under the excuse of war conditions." As the war went on, Senate committees probing production bottlenecks in the United States helped to compile and make public the records of a staggering number of similar arrangements, differing in detail, but all having the same effect. They were widely denounced, but principally on the ground that they represented business as usual during wartime. Editorials solemnly pronounced that all such arrangements should be out for the duration, unquote. These business arrangements operated at focal points where it was possible to turn on and off the main valves in economic pipelines. It was not long before we found out that the arrangement of valves and pipelines was a two-way affair. Our elation at the discovery that practically all of Germany's fine optical glass came from one factory, the Schott Works at Jena, was counteracted by the discovery that under the same working arrangement, only one such factory of any importance existed in the United States. The pinpoint for bombing in Germany could be the blueprint for sabotage in the United States. As if to add point to such thoughts about sabotage, during the summer of 1942, the Justice Building in Washington played host to the trial of 8 Nazi saboteurs who had been landed by submarine to blow up some of the key factories in the United States. Morning and evening, the black vans of the United States Marshal trundled the prisoners under our windows, and all day long, the drawn blinds on a row of windows 2 stories up and across the courtyard were a reminder that sabotage, in the literal sense of the term, was not just a theoretical possibility. But sabotage, in its literal sense, was not the point. As our piecemeal reports stacked up, a picture began to emerge of an enemy that did not need the services of trained professional spies and saboteurs. By agreement between German and American producers of magnesium needed for aircraft, production in the United States before the war was limited to no more than 5,000 tons per year. In contrast, Germany in 1939 alone used 13,500 tons, and during the next 5 years consumed magnesium at the rate of 33,000 tons per year.
6 times the American production, or more.
Here was a case where American business is businessmen had knowingly or unknowingly helped a German firm to close some valves over here, with far more effect than the 8 saboteurs could ever have achieved, even if they had been allowed to do their utmost. Plants which have never been built are more dead than plants which have been bombed. A bombed plant may still live in its blueprints and in the trained labor force that had been operating it. As the evidence piled up to show German success in negotiating restrictive arrangements, the contrast between the limited possibilities of cloak-and-dagger sabotage and the greater possibilities of safely negotiated business arrangements became more and more heavily underlined. I'd like to point out that through these arrangements, the Nazis were not only able to restrict production in their enemies, in the war economies of their enemies, but they were also able to obtain a great deal of raw material, technological know-how, and as was mentioned by Ambassador Dodd in the quote with which we began the program, many American firms had subsidiaries in Nazi Germany which were playing a critical role in German war manufacturing. Perhaps the one of the most notable of these was the wholly owned GM subsidiary of Adam Opel AG. Opel, the wholly owned GM subsidiary, was Hitler's leading tank producer. And in 1936, the Nazis had granted Opel tax-exempt status, and then Opel obligingly reinvested all of the profits in German armaments manufacturing.
We might interject at this point that the second largest tank producer in Germany was also an American-affiliated firm, Ford.
Which is interesting because the people who today are making the Cougars and Bobcats were some of the same people who were making the Panzers and Tigers.
Germans figured they owed them a word of thanks.
Okay, I think we better move on at this point. Perhaps the single most important contribution that an American firm made to the Nazi war effort was the technology transfer effected from Standard Oil of New Jersey to the giant German chemical cartel of IG Farben. There are three areas that we're going to focus on in our discussion. The first concerned Standard IG cooperation with regard to the hydrogenation process, through which oil is derived or synthesized from coal. The second concerns the transfer of isooctane and tetraethyl lead technology to the Nazis. And the third concerns the transfer of butyl rubber technology to the Nazis. Each of these was essential for the prosecution of modern warfare.
We'll explain just how essential.
Beginning with the hydrogenation process, it's important to note that the Blitzkrieg, Hitler's motorized columns and closely integrated Air Force units, obviously demanded a lot of fuel. Germany has no domestic oil reserves to speak of, and as such, the prosecution of modern war by Germany was dependent on the synthesizing of fuels. The hydrogenation process, by which oil is synthesized from coal, Germany has very plentiful coal reserves, was developed through cooperation between Standard Oil and IG Farben in the 1926 through 29 period. In 1929, Standard and IG formed the so-called Standard IG Agreement, which provided for the formation of the Standard IG Company. This was a research company, which was owned 80% by Standard Oil and 20% by IG. Now, what they each got from this agreement that was important was the following. Standard was afraid that eventually IG's synthetic oil might threaten their worldwide preeminence in the oil market. So they sought to eliminate IG as a world competitor. They did not want to have to compete with IG synthetic oil. IG, by the same token, had sunk so much capital into the development of the hydrogenation process that they were actually threatened by the amount of the investment. If they were not able to obtain capital, it is quite probable that IG as a company might have had to dissolve, and this would have been absolutely fatal for Hitler's war-making effort. So what Standard obtained from IG was an agreement, that Standard would have the rights for the worldwide marketing of oil synthesized under the hydrogenation process, except in Germany, so that IG was still in the position to develop, to manufacture, and market synthetic oil in Germany. This, however, served Standard's purpose of eliminating IG and their synthetic oil as a competitor. In return, IG not only retained the rights to manufacture synthetic oil for Germany, but more importantly, they received 2% of Standard Oil's stock. That was a total of $35 million, and this piece of capital was absolutely essential for the continued functioning of IG Farben. Without that capital, it's quite possible that IG Farben would have dissolved. Had IG Farben dissolved, the Third Reich would have dissolved and World War II would not have happened. The second area in which Standard Oil provided IG Farben with an absolutely critical element in war production concerned the transfer of isooctane and tetraethyl lead.
Basically, the significance of that is that this information and the patents involved in it enabled the Germans to make good quality gas for their road vehicles and, most importantly, for their airplanes. Isooctane is one of the substances that's used to test gasoline, and it is from isooctane that we derive the octane numbers that rate the quality of gasoline that you see on the gas pump. Standard taught IG Farben and the Germans about isooctane and about its good anti-knock properties in engines, and taught them how to make it and use it in testing gasoline. Tetraethyl lead, as many of you are probably aware, is an effective anti-knock additive to gasoline. By putting Just a small amount of tetraethyl lead in gasoline, its tendency to knock in an engine, is drastically reduced. That enables you to build the engine with a higher compression ratio that makes the engine more efficient. It makes more power from less fuel, and it weighs less and takes up less room doing it. Translating that to an airplane, it means that you need good high-octane gasoline to build a competitively fast, high-flying, long-range airplane. In other words, without this technology, Germany could never have fielded a competitive air force in World War II.
Tetraethyl lead was developed in the United States by the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation. That was jointly owned by both Standard Oil and General Motors, 50% ownership by each firm. IG Farben requested the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation to provide them with the patent technology and the technical know-how to enable them to manufacture their own tetraethyl lead. The War Department got wind of the negotiations between Ethyl Gasoline and IG and wrote a letter to Mr. Webb, the General Motors official who was president of the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation, and pointed out that providing Germany with tetraethyl technology would be giving them an absolutely essential war-making item, an absolutely a vital war commodity, and that basically they should not do so under any circumstances, because obviously this would have grave implications for the United States and its allies, or potential allies. So Mr. Webb then wrote the Defense Department, said, don't worry, we won't do that, and then turned right around and provided IG with tetraethyl lead. The granting of the tetraethyl license to IG, and this is important, was the first time that such a license was granted to any competitor outside of the United States. And it's also interesting to note that IG was not able to manufacture enough tetraethyl lead from their plants in order to meet Hitler's timetable for the invasion of Poland. So instead, the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation loaned them 500 tons of tetraethyl lead so that they could proceed with the invasion of Poland. Also sold them $20 million worth of aviation gasoline
containing tetraethyl lead.
And so as a result, Hitler's timetable was not disrupted. Interestingly enough, the collateral for this loan, which was forfeited by IG, was arranged through Brown Brothers Harriman and Company, a firm involving the Harriman brothers, W. Averill Harriman, but more importantly, his younger brother, E. Roland Harriman. And the iso-octane technology was also the first, the providing of iso-octane by Standard to IG was the first time that an iso-octane license had been granted outside of the United States as well.
One point I'd like to interject, again relating this to the present, this Ethyl Gasoline Corporation that sold this tetraethyl lead was a joint venture half owned by General Motors, half owned by Standard Oil. Again, with this plus the company that arranged the financing, we see the activities of an interlocking network of corporate power and corporation owner power that exists to this day and still functions throughout the world.
The third area in which Standard Oil provided Nazi Germany through IG Farben with an essential war component concerned the transfer of the technology for making butyl rubber.
Now, butyl rubber is a common ingredient in tires, but until the late 30s it wasn't known. Butyl rubber, apart from the fact that you don't have to have access to rubber trees in order to obtain it, is also a non-porous rubber. Most rubber has little pores in it, and if you make an inner tube or a rubber raft out of normal rubber, natural rubber, or most kinds of synthetic rubber, the air will leak out after a while, even if there are no ruptures or holes in the part that you made. However, butyl rubber is exceptionally good for sealing, so it's a common choice for inner tubes, tires, life rafts, fuel bladders, but lots of things, anything that has to contain air. There was also another kind of rubber involved in this, which was Buna rubber.
B-U-N-A, by the way.
Which is still available in the United States. It's Buna is actually a trademark. The name of that kind of rubber is nitrile rubber. Neoprene, which you may have on the soles of your shoes, is related to that. Also, the main important property of Buna rubber is its resistance to petroleum and petroleum-related chemicals. So it's very important for fuel bladders in airplanes, gaskets, seals, hoses, anything that has to resist anything that's made out of oil. Now, what happened with the Buna process is the Germans developed it, and while the Germans got access to the American butyl process, the Americans did not get access to the German Buna process.
Basically, how this worked out, in 1930, Standard and IG arrived at the so-called JASCO agreement, J-A-S-C-O, referring to the Joint American Study Corporation. JASCO was owned 50% by IG, 50% by Standard Oil. What this did was to, it was basically a cartel agreement, which assured that Standard would not interfere with IG's exclusive province, which was chemicals, and that IG in turn would not interfere with Standard Oil's oil business. Now, under the terms of the JASCO agreement in 1938, Standard Oil provided the Nazis through IG Farben with all of the butyl patents and technical know-how. They requested the Buna patents and know-how in return. And finally, after the outbreak of war in Europe, they received the Buna patents, or Buna patents. How is that pronounced?
Buna if you're German, Buna if you're American.
That sounds like Buna to me. Okay, so they received the Buna patents, but they never received the Buna technical know-how, without which the patents were really not that effective, so that it was a clear case of where Standard restricted the development of an essential component of modern warfare in this country and provided the Nazis with an equally essential element under the terms of that same agreement. I think in all of the reading that I've done about the industrial cooperation between this country and Hitler's Third Reich, I think maybe the most shocking, certainly, well, I can't say the most outrageous, one of the most astounding things I came across was a method whereby American companies cooperated with German, American insurance companies cooperated with the Germans in such a way as to provide them with really astounding amounts of intelligence concerning not only U.S. plants, but also U.S. shipping. Remember that the Battle of the North Atlantic was absolutely critical to the eventual success of the Allies. And I'd like to point out before I read this that, of course, this coming weekend is going to be Memorial Day, at which time America pauses to remember its dead from the foreign wars. Bear in mind that during the Battle of the North Atlantic, the losses among Allied merchant seamen were roughly 1 in 3. A third of all seamen sailing that route lost their lives. Keep that in mind as you listen to the following. As James Stewart Martin, in All Honorable Men, as I mentioned, the chief of the Economic Warfare Section of the Department of Justice, as he was preparing to go to Germany in 1945 to work behind the advancing Allied armies in order to begin investigating German war production, he began to reminisce. Martin writes, "On a bleak night in February 1945, I found myself standing with my small party of investigators in the mist at the Washington airport waiting to take off. As I stood in the gloom, observing all the security measures that shrouded our routine departure, the blackout of the field and the plane, the silence, the sudden orders, I remembered our discovery earlier in the war of how easily the secrecy, unquote, of ship sailings had been penetrated by the Germans. In 1940, 41, and 42, ships leaving American seaports had the same security measures to protect their departure. Yet many of their broken hulls and water-soaked cargoes had washed up onto the beaches of New Jersey, Virginia, and the Carolinas, where German submarines had spotted them within sight of shore. In case after case, every man on board had been marked before the captain opened his orders, though they may not have known it. The cargoes they carried were reinsured with Munich. The routine system of placing insurance had put precise information on their sailing date and destination in the hands of the Germans before the ship left port. In the summer of 1941, before there was any economic warfare section, several trust busters discovered that while the American public was looking more and more askance at German business connections, insurance companies doing an international business seemed to have no such doubts about their foreign commitments. Insurers of large risks, such as ships, cargoes, and industrial plants, customarily spread the risk among other companies willing to take fractional shares. The big insurance and reinsurance companies in the United States which handle the largest risks have such treaties on an international basis through arrangements with the Lloyd's Group in England or with the Zurich Group in Switzerland. It had long been the custom of the American companies to place the reinsurance on ships and cargoes with the Zurich Group by cabling information to them so that they could accept responsibility for a share of the American insurer's risk. The information cabled would include the name of the ship, the sailing date, the cargo carried, the destination, and the value of the insured property.